This morning, the Supreme Court of Texas sits for the first time in its history in Longview, Texas. The court has twice a year left our usual quarters in Austin to visit different parts of the state. We have been to every law school in the state and to four colleges and universities, and today marks yet another chapter in the history of the court and our efforts to learn from traveling around the state on these biennial tours. We have been very pleased with our reception in Longview. We had a very nice party last evening hosted by the Greg Harrison and Upshur County Bars, and we very much enjoyed the table centerpieces, which were made by students that are here today, and they've followed us, I see, to our next location. And at the conclusion of these arguments, we are looking forward to visiting with some of you about the work of the court and the law in America. We have two oral arguments to hear today. In the order of their presentation, they are Minyard Food Stores Incorporated versus Brenda Goodman from Denton County and the Second Appellate District, and Dr. Karen Roberts versus Lane and Casey Williamson from Gregg County and the Sixth Appellate District. In each of these matters, we have allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument. The petitioner may reserve a portion of that time by advising the marshal of our court for rebuttal. Then we'll take a break in between these two arguments so that we may go and discuss the first argument and discuss some other business matters that are pending. Justice Hankinson is not with us today. She had a family emergency, but the other members of the court are here, and all nine justices will participate in the deliberation and decision of these cases. We're ready to hear argument from petitioner in Minyard versus Goodman.
May it please the court, Mr. Brian McFall will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Good morning, and may it please the court. This case presents a single issue for the court's review, but it is an issue that is of importance to every employer and employee in this state. And that is an employee who is being investigated for workplace misconduct acting in the course and scope of his employment when he lies to his employer? In this case, the majority opinion of the panel of the Fort Worth Court of Appeals said that the answer to that question was yes. That it said, if an employer requires an employee to answer a question as part of an investigation, then the minute that that employee utters a defamatory falsehood, it is in the course and scope of employment such that his employer is liable. Now, Minyard's position is that the majority has misapplied well-established law of respondeat superior and has created an unworkable rule of law for all Texas employers. I will address each of those in turn. First is, how has the court misapplied applicable law? The standard for course and scope in a defamation case has been discussed by this court twice in the recent history. The first time was in Texam Oil Corporation versus Pointer, where this court said, in evaluating an issue, a split in the circuits over whether or not defamation had to be ratified or expressly authorized by an employer, the court said it did not, and that in cases of defamation, course and scope is established by showing that the actor acts referable to a duty to his employer and in the discharge of that duty. Then this court in the 1970s in the Wagner versus Caprock Beef Packers case said a little more to explain what it means to be acting referable to a duty or in the discharge of a duty. And there this court said you have to be about your employer's work or have been engaged in work that's committed to you by your employer. Now, the courts of appeals of this state have been faithful in their application of this principle and have applied it and paraphrased it in a number of ways. One such way has been to say that you are liable and something is in the course and scope as an employer if someone is acting in the scope of their general authority and for the benefit of the employer. Other courts have said that the explanation of being for the benefit of the employer means that you are furthering the object or accomplishing the object for which you were hired. Now, Interestingly, that is the standard that the Goodman Court on its face said it was applying, citing Hooper versus Pitney Bowes, a Texarkana Court of Appeals case, where the court said you have to be acting in your general authority and to further the for the benefit of the employer. The Goodman majority said that is the standard we're going to apply in this case. But unfortunately, the court only applied one part of the test.
Mr. McFaul, let me ask you, it seems to me there are a number of cases, and the typical respondeat superior liability issue is where an employee who's a truck driver driving for the employer has an accident. And to establish liability for the injuries that, say, the victim or the injured party received, you've got to prove that the driver was negligent in operating the vehicle. Now, can you say that from accepting the two prongs that you say is in respondeat superior, can you say that a driver being negligent is, the negligence is furthering the business of the employer?
Not the act of being negligent. It would be, was the driver negligent in the act of trying to further the employer's business?
Let's accept that driving the vehicle, going from point A to point B to deliver the products is in the course and scope of employment. But if they are negligent in operating the vehicle, I guess you'd agree that certainly arguably no employer would say that's to my benefit for them to be negligent in operating their vehicle.
Absolutely.
How do you distinguish that from, how do you distinguish that question from the notion that speaking to the employer is within the course and scope? I've asked you the question, speaking, but my misinformation is not within the course and scope. My driving's within the course and scope, but my negligence is also within the course of scope, but if I'm speaking to them, that's in the course of scope, but my misinformation is not within the course of scope. How do you distinguish those?
Because fundamentally, the driver is employed to do just that, drive. And in the act of driving, he was in the course and scope of employment and was negligent. The person who is the subject of an investigation, and let's take Mr. Heflin here, Mr. Heflin was hired to run the grocery store, not to become the subject of an investigation for sexual misconduct.
But you would expect in the course and scope of his employment that he would answer questions of his employer about whatever they're talking about. Whether he was the subject of it or he was simply a witness, the employer would have the right, as a part of the employment arrangement, that the employee would talk to them about.
Absolutely. And the expectation would be that the employee would respond truthfully. And in the case of the driver, the other thing that really distinguishes the two,
the expectation would be the driver would drive not negligently.
Absolutely. But the employer can protect itself in the case of the driver by making sure it trains the driver properly, making sure that it supervises the driver properly. In this case, you are at the mercy of the person who utters the defamatory statement, and there is nothing the employer can do. When Mr. Heflin was in that chair, if he would have said something about someone else, uttered it during this conversation, there's nothing that the employer can do to protect itself except never ask the question in the first place. And that's the problem for the employer. Because, as I said at the beginning, the unworkable rule of law for employers is that under the prevalent law of sexual harassment law, an employer has a duty to investigate harassment under Title VII, not just sex harassment, but religion, national origin, age, race, you name it. Courts have said you have a duty if you want to have an affirmative defense to harassment. And if the employer investigates the harassment and then finds that the employee during this investigation says something that's defamatory, two things have just happened. The employer has followed its duty and adhered to its duty to investigate and now is liable for defamation. And that's the dichotomy, the Hobson's choice that the employer has to make here.
But the difficulty that Judge Enoch raises is dealing with respondeat superior in that context. If your deliveryman gets in a fight with a customer, wouldn't the employer have to the employer be responsible for that misconduct?
I really don't know what the case. I've read cases that say if the delivery man were to drive off from his course, go two
right.
miles down, try to find someone who he thinks is sleeping with his wife, and he shoots her, the employer
right.
is not liable for that.
But if he's on the job, I mean, he's delivering something, it's purely part of his work. He gets in an altercation and he's got his uniform on, and clearly he's about his boss's business. There can be liability there, vicarious
sure.
liability there.
Sure.
Would there be if he got in a fight with a coworker?
At work?
Yeah. There might be liability
Could
there.
Be.
What's the difference between that and lying?
Because in the lying situation, what's happened here is this is the person who's accused of misconduct. So all the employer is doing in this instance is going to the employee and asking a question about his actions. That's all the employer is doing. And that if the employee, then lies to the employer, there's nothing that the employer can do.
Yeah, but you say if he goes to the employee and says, did you do this? And he says, how dare you ask me that? Pop. And hits him on the nose, there might be liability. But if he just tells him a lie, there's not. And it's hard
no,
to see the difference.
I don't think that if it's the investigator who is popped by the employee, I don't think that you would be able to say that the investigatee was acting in the course and scope by hitting the investigator. Now, I would argue as an employment lawyer that under workers' comp law that it occurred in the course and scope of the investigator's employment that he was injured. But I don't think in that scenario that you can argue that. That the investigatee is acting in the course and scope.
Just a philosophical problem here, because when you do something wrong, you're never really in the course and scope of employment, because the employment doesn't involve wrongdoing.
Sure.
But there is vicarious liability for some wrongdoing that's done in the course of employment.
And the cases distinguish that as that's where the whole element of Texam on express authorization or ratification came about. Is that it is anticipated that an employee in the course and scope of employment may say or do something you don't like. And the classic example is the Hooper versus Pitney Bowes case, where these two people who were investigating a manager's misconduct in the process of the investigation told some witnesses that the employee was a witch, was a member of a cult, was satanic, and made comments like that. And the defendant in that case, Pitney Bowes, said, well, that's not in the course and scope because we obviously wouldn't want them to say that. And the court said, well, that's a foreseeable result when you charge them with the responsibility to investigate. The fact that they became overcome with zeal to argue or to say those things was not something you could avoid. The difference, the
Would
critical difference.
Would it make any difference if the actor were the president and CEO of the company?
You mean under some theory of vice principal? You still have to be acting in the course and scope of employment, even as a vice principal. The example of that's the Heiser versus Eckerd case out of the Fort Worth Court of Appeals, where a vice principal went to a Texas Rangers baseball game, and while was at the game, told a friend, boy, you better not hire this guy, he's a thief. I think this phrase was, he stole from us, he'll steal from you. And the court there said, had no problem saying that the employer was not liable for that. The mere fact that he was, or I'm sorry, in this case it was a she, that she was a vice principal did not establish respondeat superior liability.
But if the CEO went outside his office and said, told his secretary, boy, manager Jones down in shipping is a thief, would the company be liable there?
I think that's more likely, yes. That's a completely different scenario, I would say, than what we have presently.
The only difference is this fellow's not the CEO.
Well, the difference, too, being that in this case, the person is being investigated for his own misconduct. In that case, you have the agent, the representative of the company, coming down and in part of his business of discussing issues with an employee, calling someone a thief, which in Minyard's position is a completely dissimilar situation from someone coming to you and saying you have been accused of misconduct and then lying to your employer. And I think the other issue that employers have a difficulty in Texas that we'll have with this is it essentially guts this court's privilege that it is granted, conditional privilege, to investigate complaints of misconduct. In Randall's Food Markets, this court said that employers have a privilege to do so, have a privilege to investigate. But if that privilege can be waived by the subject of the investigation, then what good is the privilege? Take this case, for example. If Mr. Heflin is permitted to waive Menard's privilege, then Gary Flowers, his boss, could have conducted the perfect investigation, could have maintained the conditional privilege, not shared the information with anyone who didn't have a duty to know, not act with malice, and the result of this case would be the same.
But you're not arguing privilege in this case.
No, I'm saying that as a matter of policy, if the Goodman decision stands, that the privilege is meaningless to employers because the subject of the investigation immediately waives it for you if he or she lies to you.
You think the critical fact in this case is the employee was answering the question of the employer, and that's what makes all the difference between this case and the questions Justice Hatch was asking about the CEO coming out and making a defamatory statement. That the difference is that the statement was made in this case in response to a question as opposed to just being a self-initiated statement.
I think that is a distinction from what Justice Heck was asking me about, but I also think that it can be applied to many other situations. If an employer has a policy, as in the Rossman case in New York, where the employer had a policy that you have to report harassment. That's our policy. We want to eradicate it. So you report harassment falsely to your employer. That scenario is the same. Why is the employer, by having a policy that to try to eradicate harassment, now vicariously liable for the defamatory statement, merely having heard the complaint? So it's not just in response to a question that the Goodman case is going to affect employers. Employers aren't going to want to mandate employees to report misconduct. And that certainly shouldn't be the policy of this state.
Is there any viable distinction on the Poynter case to be drawn from the difference between an employer being liable for an intentional tort of an employee as opposed to a negligent tort of an employee in terms of what is the respondeat superior liability?
Well, in intentional torts, it's as I quoted it. I'm not aware that negligence, that it's any different.
Does the second prong about the act being in the course and scope have more significance when you're talking about an intentional tort of an employee as opposed to a negligent tort?
From a policy perspective, I think it does.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Court is ready now to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Stephen Thorpe will present argument for the respondent.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'd like to start right where Justice Enoch and Justice Heck led us, which is a discussion of the relationship between course and scope and the performance of a tortious act. Menards has briefed and argued this case as though it were our burden to show that the actual commission of a tort was in some sense in the course and scope of employment. They say we didn't hire Mr. Heflin for the purpose of coming and lying to us. That's obviously true. No employer in the history of the world has ever hired somebody for the purpose of subjecting them to liability through tort. That's not why we hire people. What our cases have always taught us, however, is that vicarious liability depends on whether at the time the tortious act is committed, in this case the defamation, the employee was doing something which was in the course and scope of his employment, that is, a duty being performed for his employer. Now, the facts in this case and the record shows that that is exactly what happened. There were rumors about Heflin and Goodman. Menards, and it's important to recognize on its own and without a complaint from Ms. Goodman, decided that they were going to investigate those rumors.
But how do you address the situation that opposing counsel just raised about the employer who has a duty to make an investigation? Aren't we just going to have strict liability in every investigation situation, or how would you draw the lines there?
I would draw the line where an employer actually has a duty as opposed to where the employer conducts an investigation for its own purposes.
Why?
We all know that there is a strong public policy that's incorporated in Title VII and the Texas Commission on Human Rights Act that says there are certain kinds of complaints of sexual, racial, and ethnic harassment, which an employer has a duty to investigate so he can remedy the situation.
But why should theft, for example, be any different?
Well, because...
I mean, it's a practical matter.
Well, we don't have theft here.
I know either. We don't, but that's the logical extension. Why wouldn't we... What difference does it make if the employer is required by law to do an investigation and it just conducts one on its own?
The reason I would say there is a difference is because had Ms. Goodman come forward and said, I'm being sexually harassed, please conduct an investigation, then I think a very strong argument could be made that Ms. Goodman should understand that in the course of such an investigation, bad things might be said about her. And to the extent she's asking for the investigation, she has probably waived her right to hold Minyards responsible for whatever said. This is a case, however, where Minyards decided that it was in their interest to conduct an investigation. And as part of that investigation, they went to Mr. Heflin, and they made it part of Mr. Heflin's job.
But why is it in their interest in this case?
I do not know.
Well, it's to prevent this sexual harassment or any sort of allegation of it, isn't it? I mean, wouldn't they be negligent in not looking into something of this sort?
There was absolutely no allegation of sexual harassment in this case.
But there was an allegation of paramour preferences, wasn't there? There was an allegation by a co-employee of paramour preference or alleged paramour preference. And in that third person's mind, she could have reasonably believed that that was subject to Title VII or the TCHR's protections. And that employee may have had a good faith belief that there was a violation of Title VII, and she brought the complaint forth to her employer.
I don't know what Ms. Hughes believed. The record certainly doesn't establish that she had any such belief.
But I guess what I take issue with is you keep on saying the employer initiated the investigation. The employer initiated the investigation at the behest of another employee, correct?
That is not even exactly correct.
What
happened was that there were sufficient rumors, so it came to the attention of Minyard's management. There is no evidence at all in the record that shows that any particular employee demanded that an investigation be conducted.
But again, what public policy are we serving? That if rumors are going on in the workplace, don't we want employers to investigate that without facing this sort of unlimited liability?
What we want is reasonable investigations to be conducted, but we also want people who act in the course and scope of their employment to injure folks to have principals being liable for those injuries.
What if had been a theft? One of the employees reported that something had been stolen at work, and Minyards called in the police and said there's been a theft here, and the police interviewed Mr. Heflin, and he said Ms. Goodman committed the theft, and that was not true, and that he and others repeated that allegation. Would Minyards then be liable?
I think then you would probably be in the realm of the other Court of Appeals case, Lyon versus Alsup. In Lyon versus Alsup, we had a very similar situation out of the Fort Worth Court of Appeals, but the Fort Worth Court of Appeals ruled in the opposite fashion. There, the tortfeasor was a thief himself, and in order to cover his own thievery, without being required to do so by Alsup, he fired the plaintiff and then accused the plaintiff of thievery. That was a situation in which he was not responding to any request from his employer. What puts Mr. Heflin in the course and scope of employment here is he was asked by Minyards to talk about Brenda Goodman.
What difference does it make if Minyards ask the questions or they ask the police to ask the questions?
I don't know whether you could fashion...
If Heflin lies about a co-employee and slanders her, what's the difference?
I don't know if I can fashion an agency theory whereby when the police investigating a crime that's been reported to them by Minyards, does that put the police in the same status as Mr. Flowers was, Wes Heflin's supervisor, when he demanded that he speak about Brenda Goodman? I just don't know that I can stretch agency law that far.
Well, Heflin's employee at Minyards, and it's being conducted at Minyards' request about misconduct on their premises.
I didn't hear your question.
I'm sorry. It's an investigation that's being conducted at Minyards' request of Minyards' employees about misconduct that occurred on its premises that affected its employees.
Yeah.
So why isn't Heflin in the course and scope in that investigation as well as he would be in the Minyards' investigation?
I would say because the duty that Heflin owes to answer those questions from the police officer is the general duty that's owed by citizens to respond to police officers and investigations.
But he lied.
I understand he lied, but he would not be in the course and scope of employment because he was not answering those questions upon orders of Minyard's. He was answering those questions to a police officer. When Minyard says, you must talk about Brenda Goodman, then speaking about Brenda Goodman is part of his job. He is in the course and scope of employment when he answers those questions. And if he does it badly, in the sense that he commits a tort, the tort of defamation while in the course and scope, the precedents of this court have held that Minyard's is responsible for defamatory statements made in the course and scope of employment.
Okay, Mr. Thorpe, is the jury found that Heflin had slandered Goodman?
Correct.
Now, is that an intentional tort?
That is an intentional tort.
Now, are employers, through respondeat superior, generally liable for the intentional torts of employees, or is there some other element necessary to establish respondeat superior liability when the underlying event is an intentional tort?
I think that case was answered by the Supreme Court in the Texom case. And they said at least when we're talking about the intentional tort of defamation, the employer is going to be answerable for that defamation if it is made, and I've got it written here and I'll just read it to you, if the defamation is referable to a duty owing to the agent by the agent to the corporation and made well in the discharge of that duty. Now, as you, I think, quite correctly pointed out, once Mr. Heflin was asked, tell us about Brenda Goodman, he had a duty to the corporation to respond, and everything he said which constituted defamation in this case occurred during his response, during his performance of that duty. Unless we think that employees don't have a duty to respond to questions put to them by their supervisors.
Well, you would agree they have a duty to respond honestly.
We have to look very carefully, Judge, at the distinction between being in the course and scope of employment generally and being in the course and scope of employment for the purpose of committing a tort. I've already conceded that no one is ever in the course and scope of employment in the sense that they've been employed to commit torts. But in the analysis that Judge Hecht raised, suppose Mr. Heflin instead had been a truck driver, or had suppose he'd been just what he was and assigned for a day to drive a truck. He takes a couple six-packs along with him. He gets drunk. He gets into an accident. Nobody here would doubt that Minyard's was answerable for that and that he was in the course and scope, although I suspect Minyard's would be here saying, you know, we didn't hire Heflin to drink beer in the truck. Well, that's always the case in a tort where you have respondeat superior. You have to look first to see are they doing what they're supposed to be doing, in this case answering questions, and then if the answer to that is yes, Minyard's then becomes responsible for any tort committed by Heflin while he's in the course and scope of employment.
Well, that's what bothers me about the petitioner's case. But what bothers me about your case is that it does seem like we're putting an employer to a Hobson's choice to say, look, don't ask the question, then you're going to be faulted for not asking the question. But if you ask the question and you can't control what the other person says, you can be liable for the answer that they gave to a question you had to ask. It just seems harsh.
And I agree with you, Judge Hack. And that's why I said earlier that in another case, in a proper case where the issue is raised, I think you should very seriously consider whether you would carve out as an exception to the general rule those cases where it can be shown that the employer had a genuine legal duty to ask questions. And the one that is best known of that is the sexual harassment context. I would not think it appropriate for an employee to be able to make a complaint about sexual harassment, demand that there be an investigation, and then sue the employer because of the way the investigation goes. That seems to me to be a Hobson's choice and unjust. But I don't see it as a Hobson's choice where the employer decides on their own that this is something we're going to investigate. They have no legal obligation to do it, and then they're held liable for what managers do.
So if I'm advising my client, an employer, the client comes to me and says, we have a situation in the office. I suspect that there's theft going on. I'm going to have to advise him, don't ask questions about it. Do not investigate it, because if someone accuses anyone in the process, you instigated the investigation, and you're going to be strictly liable for anything that's falsely said.
That is not really the practical result of this rule.
Why not?
And you have to remember that other things happen in this case.
I'm not talking about this case, because we're writing on a broader slate.
Okay.
If we were to go your way, that would be a logical result, wouldn't it? The safer course is just don't do anything.
You would find that if an employer conducted an investigation in which it was slandered, and if, like in this case, that slander became public knowledge, and other management officials repeated it to employees and to customers, which is also in this record, then that employer would be vicariously liable.
And so my advice to the client is, don't investigate.
What I would tell, if I were advising a client, I would say conduct an investigation, but do it in a proper manner, keep the results secret and limited to the people who need to know, and do not take defamatory information, give it to junior managers, and allow them to tell other people that Brenda Goodman was moved from the store because of a sex scandal or sexual perversion, which is what was being published by Minyard's managers after the fact.
Well, is that issue before?
Go ahead.
Is that issue before us, the publication by the managers of the second store?
That is not a basis of liability in this case, but that is a response to the question of how can a corporation conduct an investigation. They can do it carefully and keep the results quiet rather than doing it negligently and spreading the results to the whole world.
But what's so ironic about that statement is if an employer does an investigation, as you suggest, and it contains a false statement, and they send it off to the Unemployment Commission or the Workforce Commission now, as it's called, and it's defamatory, there's an absolute privilege, absolute privilege. But under your scenario here, you're not even asking for a qualified privilege.
I don't understand the question.
If a defamatory statement was published to the Unemployment Commission, the employer has an absolute privilege.
Correct.
Under your scenario here, though, they conduct the investigation, and you're not even conceding a qualified privilege exists.
There is qualified privilege, but it was lost when Heflin spoke with actual malice. And that's what the jury found. Part of the definition submitted was they could not have even found slander unless they found that he knew what he was saying was false or spoke with reckless disregard. That is the standard for qualified privilege. They lost their qualified privilege because of actual malice found by the jury and not appealed today. So, I mean, I think that's the response to that. If there are no other questions.
But yes, did the jury find Minyard guilty of malice or Mr. Heflin?
They found that Heflin acted with actual malice when he defamed this good.
Which is imputable to Minyard,
yes,
because of vicarious liability,
because
not because of direct malice.
Correct, because he was in the course and scope of his employment.
And so I'm clear. The only statement that you're complaining about that led to a $325,000 verdict at the trial court was the statement that Heflin gave to Flowers, the investigator.
Essentially that they had hugged, kissed, engaged in heavy petting, and had a make-out session.
And it was the loss of Mrs. Goodman's reputation to Mr. Flowers that you predicated the complaint on.
No. Right. The loss of reputation was demonstrated by evidence to the effect that after Ms. Goodman was transferred, she received numerous telephone calls every day from people asking her questions like, how could you commit adultery? How could you betray your husband? That's where her reputation was lost.
But did you trace where those statements came? Did you trace those statements back to Mr. Heflin's statements to Mr. Flowers?
Did we trace it back to that? We traced it as far as to say that the calls were coming from former customers and co-employees of Ms. Goodman. Can we prove that Flowers went to each one of those people and whispered in their ear? No. But I don't know where else that information could have come from.
The only specific, and I know this question isn't exactly in front of us, but the only statement you're complaining of is Heflin's statement to Flowers. You do say, for reputational damages, that the general knowledge back at the former store communicated to co-workers at the new store was part of your client's damages?
We complain about every statement that Heflin or anybody at Vineyards made about Brenda Goodman. The only one we claim was made in the course and scope of employment was the one that Heflin made when he was ordered to talk about Brenda Goodman by Mr. Flowers.
And you didn't seek any damages from Heflin apart from those which you claim he made in the course and scope of his employment?
The damages were awarded jointly and severally against Menards and Heflin.
Any other questions?
Yes, your briefing discussed a New York decision. Have you looked at other states to see how they've handled this issue?
I have not found a case in line with the New York case except where we're talking about a legally created duty to do the investigation, such as exists under Title VII or the Texas Commission on Human Rights Act. I have found no case that has held that where an employer gratuitously or for their own purposes alone conducts an investigation, they are not liable for people who slander in the course of
the cases the other way, but I have not seen them either way. Either way, okay.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
In City of Midland versus O'Brien, this court said that employers have latitude to exercise their rights to supervise, review, criticize, demote, transfer, discipline, and terminate employees. The test that Mr. Thorpe has argued to you that you should establish in order to differentiate between when you have a duty or when you are just trying to be a good employer is problematic. There is no way that employers can know what advice they should give. And the perfect example, as Justice O'Neill pointed out, what if my client receives a complaint as here that there or learns that there may be sexual activity between two coworkers? How do we know if it's consensual or not, or paramour favoritism or not, until such time as we go out and investigate? And we won't. And at that point, once we ask the question, the employer is automatically liable for what is said.
But you're not couching your complaint to us in terms of some absolute investigatory privilege.
No, I don't think an absolute investigatory privilege is necessary if the subject of the investigation is not acting in the course and scope of employment.
That's what I mean. You're framing this issue to us solely on course and scope.
That's right.
Now, is the Hooper, if I recall correctly, Hooper's the case where the investigators either repeated or made up some stuff that they told the potential witnesses as they're gathering information, and there was liability there for the employer because that was in the course and scope. But you argue here that because the information that was gathered was in response to a question, that this is not in the course and scope of the employee who's making the statements. Do we have to accept what you say, which is the actual statement that's not true is not within the course and scope of the employment relationship? Do we have to overrule Hooper, or how do you distinguish Hooper's statements being in the course and scope even though they're not true and Heflin's not being in the course and scope because they're not true?
The critical distinction that we set out is the difference between lying to one's employer and lying for one's employer. And that distinction is set forth, and we juxtapose the Lyons versus Alsup's case from the Hooper case. In Hooper, it was the actual investigator, the equivalent of Gary Flowers, who the company charged to go out and figure out what was going on, that made statements in the zeal of their duty that were defamatory.
Well, you've made the distinction. If the employee is talking to the employer, there's the expectation that the employee will tell a truth to that question. But wouldn't the employer have exactly the same expectation of the investigator? When you go talk to those witnesses on my behalf, I expect you to be telling them the truth.
Oh, absolutely. In an ideal world, the employer wants everyone to tell the truth and wouldn't want the investigator to do anything other than say what they need to say.
So, but you could tell a lie for an employer, and that's in the course and scope, but you can't tell a lie to the employer because that's outside the course and scope.
That's what Hooper says as contrasted to Lyons. And the example I'd give for here, had Mr. Heflin been standing at the front of the store greeting customers, which is part of the job of the manager. He's the face that everyone sees when they go into a Minyard. And he said, "Welcome to Minyards." And a customer says to him, "You people are so friendly. I love coming here." And Mr. Heflin says, "Well, that's because I'm having heavy petting and kissing and hugging Ms. Goodman." I don't think there's any question that that is in the course and scope. He, in that point, is acting as an agent of Minyard and defaming for, in his capacity for Minyard, versus when he's sitting in the hot seat and Minyard questions him about his misconduct. I don't think, and I think the law supports this, that he is sitting as Minyard at that point, and what comes out of his mouth is what Minyard says.
But if he walks into his superior's office and makes the same comment, then what? Just out of the blue. So, you know, I've been thinking about this, and I should tell you that.
As part of just office gossip, or is he going and saying, "I've got this situation, but I'm afraid to give it to so-and-so because..."
And would it make a difference?
I think it does. I think it is clear-cut...
He's going in to gossip with his superior, you know, Ms. Goodman, she's something. But if he's going in to tell his superior, this is weighing on my conscience, the company might be in trouble, I've probably had an inappropriate relationship with Ms. Goodman, then those two situations are different.
No, in the latter, those two situations you just described are different, if that's your question. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And you might have liability for one, but not the other.
Correct.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That completes the argument in the first cause, and the court will now take a brief recess.